Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, the music of Michael Jackson. It broke color barriers on MTV, scored films, and was the soundtrack for millions of lives. But first, to Iran, where today a prominent cleric demanded that leaders of unrest be punished harshly, perhaps executed. A spokesman for the ruling clerics declared with certainty that there was no fraud in this election, and opposition leader Mir Hussein Mousavi's website was hacked. It's now blank. Sadek Sabah is the BBC's Iranian affairs analyst. He joins us. And from your vantage point, with your contacts, what are you hearing from Iran?
Well, what we are hearing is the fact that fewer and fewer people are turning in the streets, and it appears that the government is regaining the initiative and controlling the streets. But that does not mean that those people who voted for the opposition leader, Mr. Mousavi, are satisfied. The question of the election is still there, and the opposition might try other form of protests in the next few days. And the government has a big job in hand to explain to the people why their votes, as far as they are concerned, have been rigged.
Sadek, I hear what you're saying, and yet some might say that sounds like almost wishful thinking, that it's the government that has the big job, because we're understanding that opposition leader Mousavi is increasingly isolated and has promised to seek permission for any future demonstrations. It sort of feels as if the government has fully the upper hand.
Yes, they have the upper hand in the streets, no doubt about it. But senior figures in the establishment over the last few days have expressed concern about the way the government has dealt with the demonstrators in the streets. And also, they say at least 13, 14 million people who voted for Mr. Mousavi are not satisfied about the explanation given to them about the election process. They say these people may not be coming to the streets anymore, but the resentment is there, and it may erupt any time in the future over any issue.
Well, so it sounds as if you're saying that there's a feeling that you're getting from Iran that this isn't entirely over yet. But what do you make of the sermon today from the cleric calling for rabble-rousers to be punished severely, possibly executed? We heard yesterday from scholar Mehdi Kalaji that many clerics had spoken out in support of the opposition. So what do you make of this fiery speech that was broadcast today by this one cleric? What does that represent?
This particular cleric, Ahmad Khatami, he is a hardline cleric. But the fact that the authorities asked him to perform the Friday prayers today shows that they are gaining confidence and they need to threaten the opposition. But there are other clerics in Iran who do not agree with today's Friday prayer leaders, and they believe that the government must try to appease a large section of the population who voted for Mr. Mousavi.
In any event, what do you think is going to happen to the people who have been detained? 11 Mousavi campaign workers, 25 staffers on his newspaper, all detained since the election. We know 70 university professors were detained after meeting with him, all but four released. And then the people have been rounded up in the streets. A special court was set up. What's the sense of what is going to happen to them?
Well, I mean, it depends what the regime is going to do about Mr. Mousavi himself. If they give him a status as an opposition leader, then probably they will release most of the people who are associated with him. But if they decide to eliminate him and arrest him and put him on trial for treason or whatever reason, then, of course, those people who are already in jail, they would also be in trouble. We may see some people being released over the next few days as a gesture of reconciliation. But also, there is a group of people in Iran who are known as radical reformers, which the government doesn't like. Maybe this is an opportunity for the establishment to purge them and to get rid of them altogether.
What is your sense of what happens now? You've given us alternate possibilities for just about everything. Is it that sort of tenuous? It could go this way or that?
Yes, indeed. I think it is always very difficult to predict political events in Iran. At the moment, the government seems to be in control, but anything, any event, any political issue in the future can again quickly turn into a big riot in the country. This is not a society to be comfortable with itself.
Sadek Sabah, the BBC's Iranian affairs analyst, speaking with us from London. Sadek, thanks as always.
Thank you very much.
Well, since Michael Jackson's sudden death yesterday at the age of 50, there's been a lot of talk about his life, but what about his music? One young fan in Britain today says for her, Michael Jackson's death is the day the music died. Of course, that was a phrase her grandparents might have used to describe the day Buddy Holly died. And now Michael Jackson is being mourned by, I think, four generations, some of whom saw him on the Ed Sullivan Show in the 60s, others in the 80s bought Thriller, the best-selling record of all time. And when he announced his comeback concert tour scheduled for July, $85 million worth of tickets was sold in just a couple days. Since his death, we've heard much talk about his iconic status, the child molestation charges of which he was acquitted but never fully cleared in some people's minds, the bizarre behavior over the years. But today, we want to focus on Michael Jackson's music. Here now, pop culture critic Renee Graham will be our DJ today. Renee, is this the first Michael Jackson song you ever heard?
Absolutely was. I was 7 years old in 1969. The Jackson 5 appeared on a Miss Black America pageant before the Ed Sullivan Show.
And it certainly had an impact on you?
Absolutely changed everything. We went wild. Couldn't believe we were watching.
Let's listen. I remember being a little white kid seeing the Jackson 5 at the Fox Theater in Brooklyn. I was 12. They were introduced by Murray the K. What was that like for you, a young black girl in America, to see him up there?
You know, the most amazing thing about it, I was 7 when Michael Jackson was 11. Before that, the music had belonged to my parents. This belonged to us. These were kids who looked like us, but of course had far, far more talent than we could possibly even imagine having. It was amazing. It was this moment of music that really belonged to us. It was our generation. It was fantastic.
And some remind me that I think their first concert was, at least outside of Indiana, was at the Apollo Theater in New York, which was fitting.
It's a huge coming out for them. I mean, here was Michael Jackson performing on the same stage where his idols, Jackie Wilson and James Brown, had performed. It was a remarkable moment for his career.
Yeah, let's listen to their second number one hit, ABC. Now, Renee, you say this is the Motown era?
That was the Motown. It was their second hit, 1970, ABC.
Yeah. And tell me a little bit about, so they left Motown, and where did they go from there?
They left Motown in the 70s, and they went from the Jackson 5 to the Jacksons because Motown actually owned the name the Jackson 5, so they just began calling themselves the Jacksons. And the sound was more mature, it was funkier, it was less bubblegum, but still, it was a big hit.
Well, I know there's one song in particular you want to play that sort of illustrates they're growing up. This is Shake Your Body.
Down to the Ground.
Okay, Renee, so now we're just loving it. We're loving the music, but soon there's going to be some watershed moments. Take us there.
1979, Michael Jackson is 21 years old, and he's ready to really begin his solo career, and he releases Off the Wall. It's an album I think everyone knew had to come at some point because everyone expected him to go solo. But what that album did, selling 8 million copies, having so many hit records, it changed everything for him. It was one of the biggest albums of the decade.
He's about to be crowned the king of pop. Right now, sort of the prince with this. Let's listen, Don't Stop. Michael Jackson's Don't Stop from his Off the Wall album with our DJ, Renee Graham. We should mention at the controls, Doug Sugarts and Alex Ashlock are just sort of winging it today because we want to hear the music as much as we do want to hear about his life, which we'll hear a little more about. And I know you want us to hear some music, Renee, that we're not hearing a lot in the wall-to-wall coverage. Pick something.
I mean, the song that really sticks out to me from the Off the Wall album is this cut Working Day and Night, one of the best dance songs he ever made. And remember, this is a progression he's made in 10 years from I Want You Back to a song like this, Working Day and Night.
So Off the Wall, so big, people saying, how could he possibly pass that? Well, he did pass it with something called Thriller. When MTV launched the Thriller video, it was precisely at midnight on December 2nd, 1983. The nation watched. Kids stayed up past their bedtime, skipped school the next day, as this relatively new 24-hour music video channel repeated the 14-minute breakthrough video over and over. Let's listen to a little bit of Thriller. Renee Graham, how big was Thriller?
There are no words to describe Thriller. It's like an album that sold 26 million copies, still sells 100 million copies every single year. So many songs, 7 Grammys, Album of the Year. Not to mention that the videos from it became the killer app for MTV.
Okay,
Doug, after these videos, you had to have MTV to see the videos.
That's right. It sold MTV. Doug, keep it going. At the controls when this debuted was Nina Blackwood, one of the original MTV VJs. We're going to talk to her about what it was like to let that music explode out across the country and how much it did change music, change how we watch television, how we make music. You got to have a video. We are remembering Michael Jackson's music. We'll continue to do that after a break here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Oh, let's keep this playing. Maybe you came into work today, like many of us did, and tried to remember the song. You know the song, the one where he goes, why? And everyone tries to sing it, but no one can the way he can.
Get me out into the night time, for walls won't hold me tonight. If this town is just an apple, then let me take.
We are remembering the music of Michael Jackson. with our own Here Now pop and culture critic Renee Graham. But also joining us right now is Nina Blackwood, one of the original MTV VJs. She was at the control when the Thriller video first debuted at midnight on MTV. The Human Nature that we were just listening to is from the Thriller album. Nina, do you remember the, well, I'm sure you do. What was that like?
Well, it was amazing leading up to it because I know there were several weeks that we were promoing it and promoting the world premiere of Thriller. And people actually made appointments, canceled what they were doing to run home to watch this video. And then when you saw it, it not only didn't let you down, but you were just completely blown away because even though videos had existed for a few years beforehand, nothing was like this. It was a mini movie. It was amazing.
Well, and Nina, thank you so much for helping us remember Michael Jackson. We know you and other original VJs are now on the channel Sirius XM 880s on 8. And so thanks so much. I'm sure you're going to be playing Michael Jackson wall-to-wall tonight.
Yes.
Thank you so much. We want to go back to Renee Graham, who reminds us that Michael Jackson's music at this point in his life was part of other watershed moments, and that included race.
The moment was, prior to Michael Jackson, MTV had not played videos by black artists. And people forget that MTV debuted in 1981. And the only reason they were willing to play Michael Jackson is because CBS, his label, threatened to pull all of their other videos if they didn't play Billie Jean and Beat It. And, you know, within a month or so, the M and MTV pretty much stood for Michael.
Yeah, let's listen to the song that they played. It's called Beat It. Renee Graham, then there were the movies. Take us through the movies, The Wiz, Free Willy. I know you want to start with The Wiz.
His film debut was in The Wiz, which was an adaptation of the Broadway show, which was an all-black version of The Wizard of Oz. Michael Jackson played the Scarecrow. The movie itself wasn't that good, but the best thing to come out of that movie was a song called You Can't Win.
Let's listen.
You can't win.
You Can't Win from The Wiz. And then, of course, My Childhood from Free Willy, which seemed to be autobiographical. But also, I want to hear Will You Be There from Free Willy. Let's give it a listen. As we listen to this, Renee, I'm thinking, we know that also to come were the child molestation charges. He was acquitted, but couldn't shake him for some people, as we said, plastic surgery, some bizarre behavior. But I'm wondering if it's because of these songs. So, you know, so many young people so firmly identify with them, films that they saw, videos that they saw, that has helped them love him despite.
I think that's the issue. I think the music ultimately wins out, even though, you know, there was a time certainly where all the scandals and all the accusations overshadowed his music. But, you know, 20, 25, 50 years from now, people are going to be thinking about the music. They're not, they'll be thinking less and less about the Elephant Man's bones, or, you know, this chamber he was going to get to sleep in to stay younger.
He tried to buy the bones from the
original Elephant Man.
And he lay in a chamber to try to stop
aging. All these other things, you know, the issues with his changing appearance, the accusations of child molestation. I think those things, for a lot of people, will fall away. And it's going to be the music that's going to sustain Michael Jackson, which is what's always has sustained him.
That's our pop critic, Renee Graham, who's brought in some of her favorites that we aren't hearing in today's wall-to-wall coverage. Here's one, Forever Came Today. We'll go out with that. Renee, thank you so much for helping us remember the music of Michael Jackson.
Thanks, Robin.
Back after the news, here and now. How'd you like to get an IOU from cash-strapped California? The state controller says he'll start issuing $3.4 billion worth of IOUs next week if a new budget isn't passed. The state is expected to go completely broke by the end of July. The recession is forcing nearly every state to make cuts. And in Virginia, the Hatton Ferry is going to lose its state funding. Now, for more than a century, a pole-driven ferry has operated on the James River in Scottsville, Virginia. If you've ever seen the 80s TV show The Waltons, you know what we're talking about. But the state says they have to cut somewhere, and along with the ferry, other transportation services are being curtailed. 19 interstate rest areas will be shut down. Roadside mowing will be cut back, and many workers are losing jobs. But there's a move to save the ferry. Joining us on the line is Stephen Meeks. He's president of the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society. Stephen, for those who didn't see The Waltons, describe the ferry for us. How does it work?
It's actually very simple. It's a technology that existed centuries ago and was used all across the country. It's a two-car ferry that is actually it's tethered to either side of the river to a cable, so there's no chance of it drifting downstream, mm-hmm. but to propel it across the river, the ferryman actually uses probably a 20-foot pole and plants it in the bottom of the river and just slowly nudges it across the river.
Well, you know, a guy with a pole, that doesn't sound like that would cost the state a lot of money. How much is the state saving by cutting the funding?
Actually, it doesn't cost a lot of money. Up until this year, since 1982, I believe, the ferry is operated seasonally, like from mid-April to mid-October. It's only operated 3 days a week, Friday, Saturday, and Sundays. And the state has allocated annually $21,000 to pay the ferryman to run it. Now, the ferryman only gets paid when it actually runs. So if the river's too high, if it's too low, there's no compensation. So out of that $21,000, for example, last year, the state only expended $6,700 to run it.
That's all. Really, does it serve a purpose? Do people depend on it?
No. You can use the ferry to go across the river from Albemarle County to Buckingham County, but it's not done that often anymore. It is more of an attraction for people.
Like a nostalgia.
Yes, very much so.
What does it mean on that level, emotionally, to the people in the area?
It means a lot since it's the last one in the entire nation.
Yeah.
A century ago, there were thousands of them, and they've slowly dwindled down to this being the last one. So it means a lot to the community because of that status.
What are you trying to do to save it, other than talk to people like me?
Well, the Historical Society has set up a Hatton Ferry Fund to try to raise private funds to go toward the operation of the ferry. The county governing board of supervisors is set to discuss it at their meeting on July the 1st, which is actually the last day that indicating they're going to fund the operation of it. They're going to take up a vote to continue funding it at a general revenue for the rest of the year. But we're trying to work, the Historical Society is trying to work with the county and trying to determine or work out a plan for the long-term preservation of the ferry.
If you can't raise the money to continue operating it, then what? Would you put it in a museum? What would you do with it?
the ferry structure itself, I mean, it's fairly large. I mean, it accommodates two vehicles. The structure itself is not really that historic. It's just the location, the site, that is the historic portion of it.
And the idea.
Yeah. Yes.
Stephen, did you watch The Waltons?
Yes.
I thought I'd see John Boy pole across a river.
It's very possible. VDOT tried to shut it down a couple times. In 1972, John Boy actually came up and sort of brought a lot of exposure to the ferry and actually went across the ferry in a photo op.
That's actor Richard Thomas.
Yes.
Well, you might be wanting to get on that phone again. Richard Thomas. That's Stephen Meeks. He's president of the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society. They're trying to save the last remaining pole-driven ferry in America there across the James River in Scottsville, Virginia. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Certainly. Glad to talk to you.
Okay. When we come back, we'll hear the man who's helping Iranians get their message out of Iran and get information in through proxy servers. But okay now, we'll continue to listen to that theme song. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. Dozens of friends and relatives paid their respects to Neda Aga Sultan at a Tehran cemetery today. The grave of the 27-year-old was guarded by nearby police and militiamen. Neda has become an icon after an image of her that's been described as a woman appearing to lock eyes with a video camera as she dies spread around the world through social networking sites and Twitter. The Iranian government tried to block portions of the internet, but Iranians turned to proxy servers, downloading software to gain access to other people's computers. Now even some proxy servers are reporting difficulties. Ronald Diebert is director of the Citizen Lab at the Monk Center of International Studies at the University of Toronto in Canada, but he's also vice president of a spin-off of the lab, a proxy service provider called Siphon. And Ron, we know there are two sides to this coin. You can either become a proxy if you're in the U.S. or Europe and your internet isn't blocked, or you can use a proxy, someone else's computer from, say, Iran. So first of all, what is a proxy?
Metaphorically speaking, it's kind of like a bank shot in basketball. So you imagine instead of trying to access a website directly and hitting up against the government filters, the censors, instead you connect to a computer that's not banned or censored in another country, which then goes out, fetches the information for you, and sends it back to you through the same means. So there are two different models of Siphon, and this is probably the same for a lot of other technologies out there. One is a home version, right, that we say, hey, download this program onto your home computer if you want to be a proxy provider. That requires an individual in their home to set it up on their computer and then do it privately. We encourage people to do that. We offer it for download on our site. But we also mount an enterprise version, or a, you know, it's a commercial service in effect, where clients pay us to ensure that their content is pushed into these denied environments. So, for example, we're working with BBC Persian because they want their content into Iran. The difference is we control all of the proxies, right, in a very elaborate, quite complex network of nodes. And that takes the burden off of the home user. And people can, you know, click on these links and sign up to our service, and we manage their accounts for them.
So let's talk about the home service. I know you want people to be very careful when they use this service. Let's say someone downloads the software that you and others offer, and they decide to be a personal proxy. We know that they have to find some information, like their computer IP address, which I understand that you could just Google that. You can say, what's my IP address, and you'll find that. But
yep.
But what do you want people to know if they are doing this individually as using your home service technology?
Well, we definitely want them to think carefully about every aspect of what they're doing, because they're personal risks to it, there are risks to them as providers of this service, there are risks to the people who are using it. So instead of broadcasting the connections to your Siphon home computers, the model that we encourage people to follow is set this up if you know someone in Iran, if you have an uncle who is there. You send them privately the connection information. They then distribute it to a few other friends and family members. and you have 10 people surfing through your home computer that you know and trust personally. It's impossible, really, without the social network of trust being compromised in some manner, for the authorities to find out that sort of thing is going on. There's a limit to that. Practically speaking, there are only so many people with friends and family members in these countries. So in addition to that home version, we've now mounted a major enterprise-level version of Siphon. And the difference is, instead of individuals controlling these Siphon nodes, we as a service have set up these nodes. We blast the information in, contrary to the propagation model I talked about with the first version, because we assume that it's going to be blocked.
I just want to jump in to say these nodes, as you call them, you've sent us one. It's a website that's an access point. For instance, we went into a node you sent. It was the BBC. And sort of this node, you call it a right-to-know site, you yep. might blast that how many times out into the...
As much as we physically can, actually. We have what we call PSI operators. These are staff who basically work 24/7 blasting this out over Twitter, over Facebook, through email groups, as widely as possible in the hope that people will find out about the address to these nodes and deliver it to Iranians that they know, or we hope that Iranians will actually get a hold of it. We operate on the assumption that eventually the Iranians would block access to these right-to-know nodes. We're ready for that. That's not yet happened.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. We read that the government has been cracking down on proxies. Are you saying that yours... you feel are still getting through?
Well, ours are getting through. Not a single one has been blocked yet. It may happen. If it does, we're ready for it, as I said, because we have a lot of these that we can throw at them. It's like the attack of the ants. We just keep throwing these nodes at them. And, of course, they have many other competing priorities and problems to deal with right now. It's almost impossible for them to keep up with this.
Well, a couple questions for you. First of all, we read a report from the internet researcher Renesis. They located 2,000 web proxies shared on Twitter and other sites and traced them back to see who was hosting them. A lot were in the U.S., Europe, China, India, Russia, Romania. But they also found about a dozen or so Iranian addresses that they trace back to the government-run service
yeah.
provider. So are you worried that the government might not block one of your nodes, but would download your software, create their own proxy, and maybe lure opposition supporters to a site where they might then arrest them?
Yes, a Iranian agent could set up a Siphon node in Canada, entice people into using it, but that would be contrary to the guidelines that we've laid out very clearly. You can warn people as best you can, but obviously not everyone is going to follow your recommendations. And all I can say is don't use a proxy computer of someone that you don't know and trust. Now, what we are doing with our service is, in effect, becoming that trusted source. People know about Siphon. They understand where it's coming from. It's connected to the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto. If they get one of our nodes, then, yeah, use it and, you know, confirm that we are who we say we are and use it accordingly.
Well, the Iranian government must know about you as well, because the Canadian ambassador in Iran was called before the government and admonished
yep.
for destabilizing regimes. Do
yep.
you think it's because, first of all, of Siphon? And secondly, do you worry about interfering in another country's history?
Well, let me take the first question first. Absolutely, that's why the Canadian envoy was called before Tehran. Everything we do is driven by the values that are laid out in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. And all that we are doing, in fact, as a service, is offering people the same type of connectivity that an average citizen can get here in Canada to the Internet. It's up to people themselves inside Iran, Burma, China, Tajikistan, whether they want to use it or not. We're not forcing anyone to use it. We are pushing content into that country that's denied by regimes that are not transparent, that filter access to information contrary often to their own explicit laws and regulations. You know, on that level, frankly, I'm quite upfront about it. Yes, this is why I'm doing it. I believe strongly in human rights.
That's Ronald Deibert. He's vice president of Siphon. It's a proxy service provider, a spinoff of the Citizen Lab at the Monk Center of International Studies at the University of Toronto in Canada. Ron, thanks so much for talking to us, and best of luck to you.
My pleasure.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now. American journalists Laura Ling and Yuna Lee remain in North Korean custody after Pyongyang accused them of entering the country illegally and sentenced them to 12 years hard labor. The women work for Al Gore's television venture, Current TV. Well, Bob Thompson is founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. Bob, tell us more about that fledgling network.
Well, I'm 49, about to turn 50, so I am hardly their target demographic. But Current TV actually does a lot of things that you really can't get elsewhere on the cable dial, and some of the stuff that it's doing on the internet is the kind of thing that you can't get very many other places either. It's somewhere between the vast infinity of YouTube, which has absolutely no standards, and most of what's on YouTube is complete garbage, but it's also not up to the standards of what Frontline would do.
That's a big span, you know, Frontline to YouTube. But we understand that the goal of Current TV, when it was launched in 2005, was to sort of bridge a gap between traditional television and the internet. For those who haven't seen us, just describe some of these things.
Current TV, if you turn it on just randomly any point during the day, what you're going to get is a succession of what they call pods, little documentaries, in most cases created by the users. It could be anything from the dating scene in New York to what's going on in a Mexican prison. It's all over the board. And none of them go more than usually 6 minutes, and that little bar that lets you know how much time is left is there for people with short attention spans. They're promoing what's coming up in the next 4 minutes, the next 11 minutes, and all the rest of it. So it's a lot of viewer-generated content. But Current TV does a lot of professional stuff. They've got a series called Super News, which is this animated parodies of essentially what's going on in the news.
Well, in fact, it's a satirical cartoon, and we have a clip, so let's listen to that. This is where an animated Larry King character is interviewing the Hadron Particle Accelerator. In this clip, the accelerator has actually traveled to Larry King's studios for the interview.
Dr. Gunther Mueller from Austria, hello.
Yes, Larry. This morning I walked into the lab and I found that the Hadron Collider is gone. And I am flipping through the channels and I see that you have stolen it.
No, the interview was arranged by my producer, Carol, who, by the way, is a huge fan of Meerkat Manor.
We are in the middle of an extremely important...
Have you seen Meerkat Manor?
No, I haven't, but we really need our Hadron Collider.
Is this thing a time machine or a teleportation device?
Neither. We are trying to recreate the origins of the universe.
Oh, I remember that. What a crazy day that was.
Again, a clip from Super News on Current TV. So it's got its silly stuff.
It's got a lot of silly stuff. As a matter of fact, I think people who just watched Current when it first came on, it seemed a much more kind of earnest documentaries about important social issues. There is a lot of just the typical VH1-style snarky comments about pop culture.
Well, in fact, we just want to listen to a little more. Here is a clip from a program called Infomania. It describes itself as chewing up the week's media so we can regurgitate it, half digested, into your mouth. Here's a recent clip.
Some crack reporting going on this week. Sacramento's Channel 13 broke open a major story affecting the health of children nationwide.
Does this look like the face of a liar? The smiling Captain Crunch, offering Crunch berries to boys and girls across the country. But did you know there are no berries in Crunch berries?
Outrage! Also, military records show that Cap'n Crunch never actually attained the rank of Cap'n.
Okay, so we couldn't resist because there's some fun stuff. But Bob Thompson, we began by talking about two Current TV reporters now being held in North Korea. That's not funny.
No, it isn't. And if you were to go on Current TV, either if you were to turn on your cable box and find it, or if you were to log on, it's extraordinary how little evidence that you get that this has happened, or even evidence you get of how it might have happened. I got onto the Current TV website, typed in North Korea, and I got a bunch of AP Wire stories and MSNBC stories and New York Times stories. So what's happened is Current TV does a lot of this kind of comedy and goofy stuff and viewer-generated pods. They do this one series, however, called Vanguard, and this is what's won them their awards. And these are more long-form, much more kind of professionally put together documentaries. I suspect it was for Vanguard that Laura Ling and her colleague, that's what they were doing in China near the North Korea border.
And you mentioned you found pretty much no word about it, the Current TV website. That could be because we know the U.S. government has tried to be low-key about this. In other words, not to do the negotiating on the airwaves, and maybe Current TV is trying to keep its reporters safe by not talking about it at the website. Well, we don't know the end of their story, but what do you think this means for the future of, Current TV?
Well, I don't know that it's going to change much at all. I think Current TV's future is probably more threatened by trying to remain solvent in a really complicated business model situation.
Bob, one last question. We understand some of the advertising on Current TV is also viewer-generated.
Yeah, and it's actually pretty funny. Yeah, as you watch Current TV, it is advertiser-supported, and you get some of the typical Geico ads and insurance company ads and all the rest of it. But there are also advertisements done for the sponsors by some of these users. Very professional, very high quality, and oftentimes really funny. Many of the promos and the station IDs are also done by viewers. And you know, what distinguishes Current from the typical viewer-generated content that you could see on YouTube or Google Video or any number of places is that they really do have a certain set of production standards. The one thing about Current is you may not like its attitude, you may not like what they're playing at any given time, but the stuff all looks surprisingly professional.
Bob Townsend, founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University, talking about Current TV, and of course we'll continue to follow the story of the two reporters being held in North Korea. Bob, thanks so much.
My pleasure, thank you.
And a final note, my grandmother used to say that death comes in threes, old, sick, and sudden. On Tuesday, we lost the legendary Ed McMahon. Yesterday, actress Farrah Fawcett to cancer. Then the sudden death of Michael Jackson. Of course, a troubled life, but a music legacy. Kathleen from Athens, Ohio writes us, when my 83-year-old retired truck-driving, Teamster-belonging, World War II veteran Archie Bunker dad says that Michael Jackson is the best performer of all times, you know Michael broke through all barriers. We leave you with one last ballad, Heal the World. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us Monday, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.